Accession number 27450, Reel 2.
Bill Maddox, Reel 2. So, you had some leave in Brighton. So the place was... Were the troops about in the town, or were they...
Oh, yes, there? The station... When I got out of the train, by a strange coincidence, there was a troop of... A company of Durham Light Infantry all loading up, obviously, to go on the invasion, I would have thought, which, well, ought to be backup of the invasion. And somebody called across, and it was one of the... It was somebody I'd met when we were first called up in Glasgow, and he put his thumb up, you know, and said, you're lucky, you're in the best outfit, when he saw I was in signal. But we didn't get a chance to talk, but of course I don't know what happened to him, but I presume he was going on the some part of the assault.
So you weren't in Brighton on D-Day, were you? Or?
No, I wasn't in Brighton, yeah. No. We were on duty at Tegham.
Okay, so you joined 25 Mobile Wireless Section.
Yes.
So where was that?
Right, well, it was formed in Egham. And at that time, I think we were living in one of the big houses, which was called the Dell, which was on the edge of Windsor Great Park. And we had the job just before Christmas of 1944. We were told that we would be going to a warm climate, and we were issued with a tropical kit. And... We started packing up all our wireless equipment and getting it all ready for the embarkation. And then we were all sent off just before Christmas on 14 days, I think, embarkation. No, 10 days embarkation leave. And then we came back and formed up. Well, we waited for instructions to embark, and then they took us down to Egham Station, and we were put on a train. We still didn't know where we were going, of course. We thought we would be going to the Middle East with all this tropical equipment. And they took us up to Glasgow, and we boarded a ship called the Tegelberg.
Tegelberg?
Tegelberg, yes, a Dutch... passenger boat.
Right. Was this a sort of liner or...?
Well, it was... Yeah, not... Liner's probably too grand a word. But it was a nice boat of about 14,000 tonnes, as I recall.
Right.
But it was a modern one. It was a modern Dutch cruising boat.
Mm-hmm. And this would be in January 45, wouldn't
it? January 45, yes.
So still no idea where you were going?
We still didn't know where we were going.
Were people guessing, trying to work it out?
We thought we'd probably be going to Egypt or Italy or somewhere like that, because that's where all the excitement had been over the past couple of years, till the time of the invasion. We knew, obviously, unless it was a deliberate deception, that we weren't going to France or weren't going to Europe, not with tropical kit. So we could only think of the Middle East somewhere.
Did you follow the progress of the war closely? Did you get much information about what had happened in Normandy and how it was going?
Oh, yes, I think we did, yes. Well, mainly from the radio, I think. Yes, we did pretty well. And, of course, in Egham at that time, it was one of the areas where the first buzz bombs fell, and we heard those occasionally and used to look up and see them coming over and wait for the engine to cut out and then wait for the explosion. And so in that sense we were aware of what was going on.
So the Tegelberg, do you remember walking up the gangplank, and where did you get sent to your berth and all that?
Yes, we got sent down to one of the lower decks, as I recall, and were given bunks and nowhere to put our equipment. Of course, we had all our own personal equipment, kit bags, rifles, tin helmets, and the problem was storage. And So mainly we slept in the clothes that we were in. We didn't go in much for niceties of pyjamas or anything. And we were told we got to sleep with our boots on in case of submarine attack, which at that time wasn't considered a very severe threat, I don't think, but just the ship, when the ship went out, we picked up a convoy off Glasgow and then sailed right out into the North Atlantic to avoid submarines. And on the first night, I remember they did let a couple of depth charges off, so we did wonder whether there had been any submarine near, and it was all quite exciting.
Mm-hmm. What was your daily routine like on board?
Oh dear, pretty boring, eh? Yes, because that was the problem, what to do with us. So we did lots of boat drill, practiced at our various mustering stations in case of having to abandon ship, and a lot of people played Housey Housey, as it was called, and they asked for volunteers to help man the wireless room on the ship from my section, of course, because we were all trained operators. So some of them did go into the wireless cabin and listen out for the Morse, and we could read what other ships were saying, because all the communication at sea, because of the wireless silence generally, most of the communication was by semaphore lamp, and we could read, of course, what other ships were saying as they passed. They would give their name and their cargo or whatever, and say bon voyage and such things. Nothing very exciting, really, but it was interesting to watch what other ships. But we were in a very large convoy, and the convoy, of course, is limited to the speed of the slowest ship, which was an old tramp steamer, which I believe was only about 10 or 11 knots. So we went very, very slowly at first in this convoy, and quite often the convoy zigzagged to make it difficult for attack. And it wasn't until we got out of the Atlantic and into the Med properly that our ship was able to leave the convoy and go on ahead on its own. But the convoy was, of course, for protection.
Mm. So when you were in convoy, if you went up on deck, what could you see? Were you in the centre of the convoy? Was it a big convoy?
Yeah, it was a big convoy. All you could see was ships all the way around. And you could tell you were zigzagging sometimes, because you stood in the ship's bow, you could see the wake that you'd made. Mm. But there was an awful storm when we got into the Bay of Biscay, I remember, and everybody was sick.
That must have been pretty grotty.
Yeah,
really,
pretty grotty, really, yeah. Mainly standing. But it was really terrific. And then we went into fog, and the ship sounded their sirens every so many seconds so that they could warn each other where they were, to avoid collision. And I can remember peering through the fog and seeing one ship, really, the ship in front, very close to us, and it sounded its horn, and we seemed to drop back a bit and not get too close.
It's quite an eerie sound, isn't it?
It's very eerie. At sea, it's extraordinary. It's like it's a hollow sound, as if you're in a chamber and somebody sounds a foghorn, and it echoes, and it's extraordinary, and everything seems oily.
So through the Straits of Gibraltar.
Yeah.
And then off on your own.
Because we didn't need the protection of the convoy anymore.
Did that feel better then?
Oh yeah, it felt better. Yes, yeah. And we could.
Because it was quite nerve-wracking, I imagine, all that time out in the Atlantic.
Well, yeah, it was a bit. Yes. It was very slow. And, of course, there was a destroyer or destroyers running round us, you know. And you did wonder, really, because it was lack of information. Nobody told you anything. And you still didn't know where we were going. And we thought, well, here we are, Gibraltar. And as you say, we hope we could go off on our own at a more comfortable pace. Then we arrived at Suez. Right. And we thought perhaps we'd get off then, but no, we stayed in Suez. And I think at that point they said we were going to India. We got at last the idea that we were going to India. So, and that was as we went through the Suez Canal.
And what was the crew of the Tegelberg? Were they British or Dutch?
They were Dutch, and I would say Dutch East Indies, as it was then. You know, it had a Dutch officer crew, but all the work was done by East Indian seamen, I suppose.
Yes, yeah.
From Jakarta, I would imagine. Mm.
Did you talk to the crew much, or you just sort of...
No, not usually.
As it were?
No, not usually, we didn't, no.
Mm. And where did you mess? Did you have a dining hall, or were you...
Oh, we ate down on the deck where we slept. Yeah. All cooped up.
Yeah. What was the food like?
Well, it was fairly routine food. It wasn't bad food. And we were always hungry, of course, but that was partly our age, I suppose, rather than the, and there was always a great bag of ship's biscuits you could help yourself to. That's the one thing you could have as much as you wanted of, and they were like cast iron, so it's not surprised they let you have as much as you want. And we could always fill up with those and a mug of cocoa. I seem to drink more coke and eat more ship's biscuits than I did anything else, because I was always hungry.
Yeah. So, getting a bit warmer now, so you were into tropical kit and...
Yes.
And what was that cruise like through the Suez Canal and then into the
ocean? Oh, it was very nice. People, it was our first chance to see a town without blackout or anything like that. You could see lights. It was all quite surprising. And then of course the Suez Canal is quite narrow, and you could wave to the locals as you walked along as the ship went past, and you'd see them shouting various, not always complimentary remarks from the bank, and we'd shout them back. And quite interesting, really, quite good fun.
Yeah.
And of course it allowed you a chance to lie on the decks and sun yourself a bit. You could gradually get used to a bit of sunburn.
Mm.
And we used to sit on the deck playing cards and all that sort of thing, which passed the time quite well.
So it sounds as though life on the Tegelberg
got more pleasant. Got better as we got further out. Yes, it did, yes, yes. Although because of the number of troops on the ship, they had to maintain a certain rigid sort of timetable, and the discipline, of course, had to be fairly strict because of sheer number of people.
Mm. So where was your first port of call?
The first port of call after Suez, uh-huh, or Port Said, was
did you go to Sri Lanka or...
Yeah, Colombo was the first port of call, yeah. Yeah. I'm just trying.
And were you allowed off there?
No, we didn't. We just stopped for fuel, I think, and food. Took on fruit and supplies, probably over 24 hours, and then we sailed on to Bombay.
And were you allowed off there, or...?
Bombay, yes, we disembarked, that was it.
Right.
That was our destination.
What was your first impression of Bombay?
It was a busy, bustling city with coolies walking up and down the docks with great bags of this and that, carrying enormous great weights. A very vibrant, bustling place, and very hot and smelly. My first impression.
And what did they do with you then?
Well, then we marched down the gangplank, got all our equipment, and we had to wait for a few hours on the boat while they got the transport arranged. And then a train came down for us, and a train came and we went down the gangplank and got on this train, sat there for some time wondering what was going to happen next. And the train pulled off, and off we went. We still didn't know where we were going. But in my case, my section, we were destined to go to Burma, although we didn't know it at the time. So that meant for us a trip right across India by train from Bombay up to Assam. But in order to get there, you had to cross India, of course, which amounted to, I think it was 14 days on the train, not the same train, but 14 days travelling on different trains.
So you were living on the train?
So we lived on the train for a fortnight, yes.
That sounds quite tough, really, in that heat, was it?
It wasn't, because it's all very relaxed. I mean, we weren't now in an infantry unit or anything like that. We were now 25 wireless section. There was only 25 men in the whole section.
Really?
We were part, of course, of a big troop movement, but within our little section was just the one officer, one sergeant, one corporal, and us. And we all knew each other well, and we used to sit on the train went so slowly that you could almost walk beside it at times, and most people had the habit of sitting on the in the doorways to keep cool because it was very hot, and it was quite a revelation to see India, to see the changing landscape and the local populace. Every station we pulled in at, you got bombarded with people wanting us to buy pen knives and various bric-a-brac that they still do in India. And what we wanted more than anything was to make a mug of tea. I remember that. And the first stop, we found that the generous nature, he'd the NG. And then a gradient, there wasn't steam, so he had to stop and pick up more water. After that, he wouldn't let us have any more water, for just had to do without. But that was fun.
Do you remember the name of the officer in your section?
Oh, yes, Abbott.
And what rank was he?
Lieutenant.
Yes, yeah. What sort of a chap was he?
A very nice chap, farmer's son. Of course, he was called Bud, naturally, to us. We always called him Bud Abbott. But I think his initial was RC. I don't know. I'll have a look. I've got a bit of paper with his initial on.
And the NCOs, do you remember any of their names?
Yes, one was Sergeant Knight, who sadly is now passed on, who we called Queenie, because Queen of the Night, very quick. That was it, Queenie Knight. Nice chap. He ran a boarding house in the Isle of Wight after he came back. And we had a corporal, whose name I forget, a Welshman. And he was all right.
So were you quite just a family, quite a unit?
Oh, yes, yes, we were.
By
nature of the size of the unit, we were 25 wireless section, completely independent. We had a job to do, but we weren't part of a bigger unit. We were just on our own. And wherever we went, we set up camp, just us, 25 of us. And
so across India to Imphal.
Yeah, we went right across India. And we had to cross the Brahmaputra and the Ganges rivers, and had to change from narrow gauge rail to wide gauge and then wide gauge to narrow. That's why we had different trains at different places. And I remember when we stopped to cross the Ganges and wait for the ferry to take us across the Ganges, we had to wait all day, I think, and we sat in some sand dunes, as I thought we were, and we got our food out and had a brew up and made a cup of tea and sat and ate whatever we got, which I think was probably beans and tin bacon or something like that. And I remember leaning out saying, oh, it's not so bad after all, and I felt something hard. And I put my hand on it, picked it up, and it was a skull. Because we were sitting in a burning ghat, and we didn't realise that we were. We thought it was just a sand dunes, but they were old burning ghats. So there was still a lot of dry bones lying about. And it's a bit of a shock. But it was...
You didn't defend the locals by doing that.
Well, it would have done, but there were none there, none that close. Mm. It might have upset them, yeah.
Would have done it. You saw the great rivers.
Yes.
Spectacular.
Amazing, the width of the Brahmaputra was extraordinary. The bank seemed so far away. And, of course, we crossed it on a flat-bottomed, very ancient ferry with a smokestack sticking right up. And I thought, we'll never make this. But we did. And it was packed, not just with us, troops, but all the local population, of course. I don't know where... They seem to spend their whole time travelling on trains from one village to another, or ferries crossing the river. But of course, in India at that time anyway, the main transport was trains, and if a village wanted to go to another village to visit his family, he usually just waited for a train to come along and sat on the outside and hung on to get a free lift to the next village.
So you arrived eventually in Imphal.
Well, first of all, we got to the railhead, which was Dimapur, which was in northern India, or Assam, and that was as far as we could go by train, and we had 2 or 3 days in the camp at Dimapur waiting for vehicles to take us into Imphal. And
what was Dimapur like? Was that sort of holding unit?
Well, it was a holding unit, an enormous holding unit, and it was rainy and wet, and there wasn't much water, I remember, and it was... We had to queue up at a standpipe to get water, and we were in tents, and it wasn't very pleasant, but we managed all right. And eventually, we got lorries, vehicles to take us up the Burma Road to Imphal, and that was a spectacular journey.
Was it? Tell me about that.
Well, the Burma Road, it was the Indian end of the Burma Road, of course, which eventually finished up in China, as you probably know. And the road was jungle covered, and no parapets, nothing to protect you as the road wound up and up these cut out of the side of the steep hills, and it was extremely hair-raising at times, because the Indian drivers seemed to were very cavalier in the way that they drove their lorries quite near the edge at times. And of course, when we met vehicles coming the other way, we had to stop to let them pass, and we were all crammed in the back of these lorries and looking over the edge of the precipice half the time with our hearts in our mouths. But it was interesting, because that's the first time I saw it was in Assam, which of course is a great tea growing area, and you could see the women on the hillsides with the baskets on their back picking tea. And so that was quite interesting to watch, and you could see the way that the land was terraced. If you looked down, it's rather like being in the Pyrenees or somewhere, you could look across and see the cultivation in the next valley. And it was really, scenically, it was very impressive.
Quite exciting. I mean, you've yes. seen so much since you left England, haven't you?
Yes, it was almost too much to take in. You know, almost got, not blasé about it, but you, gosh, you know, having not really, had never travelled abroad before and just spent a quiet life in Brighton, it was a quite a revelation, really, yeah. Mm.
So did you get up there in one day, or was this a, I don't know how far it is, yeah.
I think it took us 2 days in the, 2 days, yeah. We stayed overnight in one of the hill stations. It was jolly cold, I remember that. And then, because we were climbing all the time to get to the plain of Imphal, which is quite high, but it's a plain of several miles width, surrounded by jungle-covered hills. And that was, of course, the limit of the Japanese advance. They got to the edge of Imphal. But when we got there, they'd already been repelled and 6 months earlier, so...
What did you know about the action against the Japanese in Burma? Were you sort of well-informed on it?
Or? Oh, yeah, we were pretty knowledgeable by then, because with all this travelling, we had plenty of time to chat about it, and you read about it in the local papers, in the Indian papers. The Indian had lots of papers published in English, of course, as well as, and you heard about the war and the limit of the Japanese advance and the fact that they'd been returned at Imphal and the battle at Kohima, which had gone on 6 months before, I suppose. Mm. And but when we got to Imphal, we set up camp.
What sort of a place is Imphal? What did you see? Imphal,
it's a vast plain of... there's a small town, town in the middle, of a shanty, or not shanty town, but a typical Indian town, and surrounded by high hills, as I say, scrub, covered with scrub and jungle, and very hot. And we were looking for a place to camp. Well, this again was, now we were the wireless section all on our own. So Bud Abbott, the officer, he looked round and found a suitable place for us to camp, and we set up camp with half a dozen bell tents, a bit like a Boy Scout camp, really, fire in the middle, and we were we were there, I suppose, about 6 weeks. And you say, why 6 weeks? We were waiting for our big vehicles, because being a mobile wireless section, I should have explained, we had very big transmitters, Marconi Swab 8 transmitters, which were the biggest, I think, in that theatre of war. And they needed long trailers to carry them. And we went on ahead while the vehicles with the trailers brought the transmitters up through the hills, but of course it took them much longer. We had to wait at Imphal for them to catch us up, and we were there much longer than we'd expected. I suppose we
so
must
about
have been
6 weeks. Yeah.
Oh, I think a good six, probably more.
Yeah.
Because they had such a problem coming up the Burma Road that the vehicles kept overheating and the brakes gave way, and they were called Pantechnicons then, but it's really, nowadays you call them a HGV, a heavy goods vehicle, you know, with a big trailer with all the wireless equipment. Two of them there were with our unit. One carried the transmitters and the other one carried the receivers and the operating room.
I'll stop you just there. Bill Maddox, end of reel 2.